Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for January 15th, 2017. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Georgia's 5th District, home of Congressman John Lewis.
There we go.
Yes, and we will get into that. You're foreshadowing that topic later. And welcome, Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, and I need to do a quick shout-out, too. My brother will have a birthday in 2 days, but that's not what this is about. But 50 years ago today, my brother was sitting at the first Super Bowl game. And for you football fans out there, I think that's very cool that I know somebody that was at the first Super Bowl. So there we are.
That
David.
Is cool.
Yes, it's just something how it was played so much earlier back then. Well, let me kind of set up the show here in just a few minutes, like 2 or 3 minutes. Dr. J.M. Michael Bitzer from Bowtie Politics in North Carolina, he's going to come on and join us. One of the more interesting Twitter feeds around for politics. He also writes from Old State. Political blog, covers a lot of stuff in North Carolina particularly, but has actually had a lot of national news on his Twitter feed as well. And so we're going to have a visitor here in a moment as I reach out for it. Just a little housekeeping. Next week we may go a little early because of Kim alluding to football. The Falcons are definitely going to be in the NFC Championship game, and there's a decent chance it'll be in Georgia's 5th District, and I'll most likely be there. Tim want to watch. This is so big. Catherine, you've probably started following football at this point, right?
No. No.
Okay, not that good. But okay. Yeah, and I am traveling down the road if you hear any kind of car noise, and we're going to try to get Dr. Bitzer here on in a minute. I'm trying to make sure he hadn't called in on us. And Tim, are you watching the board as well? Just so I don't have to keep taking the phone away from my face.
No, I'm not, but I can get to it.
That's okay.
In
I'll
just
keep doing what I'm doing. But let's kind of just get into it, and even though we'll probably want to get into it more later, late in the week, when really it's been going on all week, Donald Trump has really attacked Atlanta, if you will. Atlanta is the headquarters of CNN, and he, during his press conference, went after the reporter, Jim Acosta, called the whole network fake news. I was in CNN Center yesterday. Looked pretty real to me. Not sure that the National Enquirer or Weekly World News or something else that we would truly call fake news has quite that much capacity. But John Lewis questioned his legitimacy. Now, we can get into legitimacy in elections is kind of on a scale. I mean, there's some elections that are more and some that are less, and there's a scale in there. And Donald Trump didn't like it. Then he not only attacked John Lewis as a talker, not a doer, and then he went so far as to say he needs to take care of his own district, which is pretty much the entire city of Atlanta and some other places. And I think the Atlanta Constitution this morning kind of defended the city to Donald Trump's attacks. Catherine, you're the resident of the city. What's your initial thoughts on this?
Well, it's the home of how many Fortune 500 companies? We've got Coca-Cola, UPS, Delta Airlines. I mean, there's a whole bunch of them that, help the city thrive. Our crime rate is not as high as Donald Trump would lead you to believe. I think I saw somewhere, like, in large cities where, like, 14th or 15th, which, you know, I mean, crime is crime. It's unfortunate, but, you know, it's not like we're I mean, I live here. I walk around at night. I don't worry so much about – I mean, we all think about crime, right, anywhere. But, yeah, I think he bit off more than he can chew on this one. Just looking at Twitter and Facebook, there's, like, so many people out there defending Congressman Lewis and talking about these very things, you know, home of all – I mean, we've got – the Beltline, which is recognized internationally as a incredible asset to a city. I mean, there's just a lot here. The Center for Disease Control, Emory University, Georgia Tech, Georgia State, one of the largest state universities in the country. I think President-elect Trump probably regrets making those remarks. Or maybe he doesn't. Who knows?
Yeah, I'm not sure he's so big on regrets. One thing I thought was interesting, Paul Krugman, New York Times reporter, not an Atlanta resident, actually tweeted out a graphic that started in 1986. Wonder if he chose that year on purpose, since that was the year that John Lewis was first elected to Congress. Till now, and Atlanta's crime rate just dropped and dropped and dropped, and then had a little slight uptick just in the last year or two. But that graph was very telling. Now, I would say Donald Trump probably doesn't know a whole lot about our area, but if he would have said that to, say, David Scott, that his district's declined a little bit, might have a little more to say. But really, Atlanta is improving, the actual part that John Lewis represents. So it shows that he had no clue. Also, he had no clue on John Lewis's history, because John Lewis definitely in the 60s was a doer, not a talker. So he just really can't.
And still is.
And some of the, but if you're in Congress for serving the people, I mean, I consider that doing, and I think most Americans would. But then furthermore, there was another component to this that Donald Trump was going to visit the African American History Museum on MLK Day, and all of a sudden he's canceled the visit. Tim, do you think that's coincidental?
Why, of course it is, David. his staff put out a quick little thing to the media. It said the president-elect had scheduling issues. Isn't that amazing that he just suddenly had scheduling issues when, you know, he was ready to go just a couple of days ago, and then this happened, and then he's not going. You know, I was reading here what Trump said about him. All talk, 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 he said. No action or results. Sad. And I was thinking about 1965. Now, in 1965, Donald Trump was filling out deferments to stay out of the service. That's about the chief thing he did that year. And we know that John Lewis was over in Selma getting his head busted, you know, for civil rights for people. How can he say that man's not a doer, that he's not a man of action? I mean, what is he thinking? Yeah, I'm with Catherine. Who knows what he thinks, or if he thinks, or anything. I don't know what to say.
it was such a strange line of attack. It came at a time when which MLK weekend is coming up, and Congressman Lewis is so integral to that, because he, you know, marched and fought for all this with Dr. King. He represents Dr. King's home district, and then to bring this all up on this weekend, I know it was in response to John Lewis's comments, and I would like to get into that. Of course, I'm still trying to produce the show, but, you know, a lot of times some elections are more legitimate than others. You know, and I'll mention two cases, one in each party. When LBJ beat Barry Goldwater in 1964, and it was such a blowout, there was not much you could question. when Ronald Reagan won re-election in 1984 and Walter Mondale won one state, there was not a lot you could say. But then in 2000, when George W. Bush won for the first time, or when Rutherford B. Hayes beat Samuel Tilden, those elections were less legitimate than the first two. There is a sliding scale. And if you wanted to put these things, you know, some kind of scale up, Donald Trump's election, maybe the Rutherford B. Hayes election was less legitimate, but it's at the very end of the scale. And if anybody wants to be fair, that's just the case. Catherine, am I crazy saying this?
Well, you know, I think, I hesitate to say it's an illegitimate presidency just because, I mean, I'm disappointed because, you know, Secretary Clinton got so many more votes and so many more popular votes. But the Electoral College is the way we decide these things, and he won that. So I get that. Now, the interference from Russia, the alleged interference from Russia, makes everyone question it. So, but I'm not one. I'm not going to challenge Congressman John Lewis's opinion about whether or not Donald Trump is a legitimate or illegitimate president. That's certainly his prerogative to feel that way, and he's certainly closer to that information than I am. And it's just so childish to go after someone who just makes a statement like that, especially so. I mean, the timing could not be worse for the president-elect to do this to a beloved man on MLK weekend. I mean, it's just the visuals, it's just all bad. And I think, like I said, I think he bit off more than he can chew.
Oh, yes. You go ahead and respond to that question as well. Is that just a crazy thought that some elections are more and less legitimate than others, and that doesn't matter about your political persuasion?
No, that's very true. You made allusion to the election of 1876, where Rutherford B. Hayes absolutely lost both the Electoral College and the popular vote. And his agents came down south, and naturally Florida was one of the prime states they went to then, Louisiana and a couple of others. And they targeted southern states. Union soldiers were still occupying the south, and they promised the south home rule if the electors would change their votes. And in return, Hayes would agree to serve only one term. And that is exactly what happened. The election, albeit legally, because the electors in a lot of states are not bound to vote, you know, the way their states do, although they are in most states. You know, they changed their votes and gave the election to him. You know, did we think Bush was the legitimate president? Oh, come on. What put it over for Bush, that South Florida chapter of Jews for Pat Buchanan? Come on.
Let's go ahead and transition through to our guest at this point. Welcome to the first time to the Kudzu Vine, Dr. Michael J.M. Bitzer. Welcome, Dr. Bitzer.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Yes, thanks for being on. Well, Dr. Bitzer, I kind of introduced you earlier in the show, mentioning your Twitter feed and how interesting it's been and provocative, particularly when North Carolina has been in the news a lot. But let's back up and just kind of tell our listeners about your background and in and out of politics.
Well, I grew up in the upstate of South Carolina. I'm originally from Clemson, and so I'm still coming off the high of the national championship, needless to say. Mm. But have a bachelor's degree from Erskine College and a master's from Clemson and a PhD from the University of Georgia. And basically, my graduate studies have focused on Southern politics and U.S. politics in general. And I've been teaching at Catawba College in Salisbury, North Carolina since 2002. And I'm a professor of politics and history and also serve as the provost and interim dean of students. And in my spare time, I do a lot of political analysis for North Carolina for a lot of different newspapers, radio stations, and TV stations. So needless to say, it's been keeping me busy for the past couple of years.
Yes, and kind of piggybacking on that, your Twitter feed's known as Bowtie Politics, and that may actually be used other places on social media. Tell us about Bowtie Politics, how that came about, and then anywhere else you blog and reach out to.
Yeah, I actually got interested in Twitter as kind of a news feed source. I found it, you know, early on very helpful just to kind of keep track and to see what instantaneously was developing. And I wear bow ties, so that was just kind of a natural user ID for me to go with. And it is really kind of, to my chagrin and amazement, has really kind of taken off. And I post a lot of research. I post some ideas, some interesting perspectives on it, and mostly about North Carolina politics, but U.S. politics in general as well. So I'm there. I'm also I've got a personal blog site at www.oldnorthstatepolitics.com, and then I also do an occasional blog piece for WFAE, the NPR station in Charlotte, for their political blog, what's called The Party Line.
Yes, a lot of places to read you, and like I said, I follow you on Twitter, and I'm sure some of our listeners have picked up on it, maybe more will based on this. Well, we're going to get into North Carolina later, but I want to ask the first question politically, and then I'm going to pass it to Catherine and Tim. And that would be about Donald Trump and how he has been handling the media during this transition period. We've been seeing and hearing rumors, and this week with the press conference and then the report that came out today, it's really hit a fever pitch. What is your thoughts on how he's handling the press? Will this work for him? Will this backfire? Just address that.
Well, so much over the past probably 2 years now, ever since he declared a little under 2 years ago, I think any predictions about Donald Trump need to be taken with a huge grain of salt, simply because he has been able to rewrite a lot of the rules of the game of politics to his favor. So much of what he did during the campaign really broke a lot of the traditional rules that we as political scientists and political analysts kind of say, well, if he's going to insult veterans or if he's going to insult minorities, you know, he's basically going to implode himself. And I think we've seen that he has been able to utilize his past experience on TV to really kind of reset the rules of the game and do it to his favor. And I think the press conference certainly demonstrated this past week that he's going to be able to deal with the media in a very adversarial way. He basically called out CNN and their reporter, Jim Acosta, and refused to accept any questions from them. Now, all presidents have an adversarial relationship, no matter the political party, with the press from time to time. But this is really taking it to a whole new level, kind of DEFCON 4 almost. And the president is still the president-elect. He hasn't been inaugurated yet. So I think that he is really playing by a different set of rules, and maybe the media is still trying to catch up and trying to figure out how exactly to deal with this presidential administration coming in.
Yes, and I guess it got even worse after that press conference. The report, if it happens, that the new administration may come in, throw the press corps out of the White House, which they usually are allowed to have desks, and there's the press room and what have you, may clear that out. Or I guess I could see them clearing out some reporters, New York Times, Washington Post,
that's a good question. I don't know. I think his supporters certainly are still behind him and will be for some foreseeable future. I think if he does get aggressive against the media and particularly relocates or perhaps isolates some major news organizations to the detriment of themselves and allow others to be within the White House proper, you know, that will really kind of reshape how the media and politicians, and particularly the White House, interact with each other. You know, the reports that I'm seeing is perhaps the entire White House press corps would get moved over to the old executive office building, which is part of the White House complex, but perhaps be able to better accommodate a huge interest of even outside the country, news organizations coming in and wanting to cover the Trump administration. If he does isolate and perhaps picks some folks to be within the White House versus other organizations outside of it, we really don't have anything precedent to say this is how this would play out. You know, presidents have that luxury of being able to create space. Really, it was Nixon, by covering over the old White House pool, that created the White House press briefing room. And one of the questions that I have is, will they continue to do a daily briefing? I mean, this is probably the major outlet that the White House and the administration gets the opportunity to shape the narrative, to put their perspective on the news of the day. If they decide not to go with a daily White House news briefing, that's really going to shake things up in terms of how the administration is able to craft their narrative. Now, certainly they could use the social media that Donald Trump is known for, particularly Twitter, to perhaps shape that narrative. But it would be a whole new dynamic that I just don't know we have any sense of how that would play out in the public at large.
Yes, it's just part of that greater question and norms. But I can't ask all the questions. I got to be fair to my co-host. I'm going to pass it to Catherine Smith, and then she'll pass it over to Tim Shiflett. Catherine?
Sure.
Thank you so much for being on with us tonight. We've been looking forward to it all week. So we're happy to have you. I want
to
talk a little bit more about this. So I believe that he is going to use social media, specifically Twitter, to a large extent. And I would not be the least bit surprised if they stop doing the daily briefings. I think that it's, he obviously is not really capable. Oh, I shouldn't say that. Doesn't seem willing to, you know, accept questions. So what does that look like? You know, 6 a.m. tweets from the president with the, you know, sort of policy agenda for the day. Like, how do we handle that?
I think we're all up in the air about how conceivably it will be handled and what the American public will react to. I think if he continues this strain of sending out attack tweets, going after people like John Lewis as the most recent example, I think people will begin to wonder what kind of stability there is in a presidential administration, and in particularly the president. You know, while we have different presidents bring in different styles of governance, I think the big thing that the American public generally tends to look for is some kind of stability and predictability. And I think this is a whole new ballgame with what we have with the incoming Trump administration.
So I agree with you. I mean, that's what I look for. But I am beginning to believe, well, I guess after the results of Election Day, I think that there's a large group of people, whatever the percentage, the actual percentages of voters were, that actually aren't looking for that. They want this sort of wild card. They, I think that's why they voted for him, that they want, they're tired of this status quo stability. They want someone who's going to, you know, change things up and talk back to the international leaders and be more, you know, today I read that they're talking about limiting support, financial support to Africa. I mean, there's just like so many things that are being discussed that change the whole global scene. But I think, I mean, I agree with you. I think that what as thoughtful, considerate citizens, we want stability. It's important. But I do think there's a large group of people who don't are not as concerned about that as you and I might be.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you look at the exit polls coming out of November's election, nearly 40% of the electorate said they wanted change. And in particularly, if you look at the other question, was the country on the right track or the wrong track? 62% of Americans said the country was on the wrong track. Now, I think, you know, unfortunately, they didn't do a deeper dive into that question of
right.
Well, why do you think that the country was on the wrong track? But overwhelmingly, people voted who said the country was on the wrong track and wanted change, voted for Donald Trump. Now, you know, he's coming in to this new administration with a kind of sinking public approval rating that we haven't seen in modern American politicians. Usually they get this thing called a home, you know, a honeymoon period of typically
yeah.
the first 100 days or first three couple of months. This doesn't seem to be playing out as we normally would expect. So I think we have to be able to say, we don't know what's going to happen, honestly. And, you know, when it comes to the daily press briefings, I would just say that's always done by the White House spokesperson. So Sean Spicer would be the person kind of leading that. If Sean Spicer chooses not to, I think that's a whole new dynamic that we can say, well, this is uncharted territory that we're working our way into.
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of uncharted territory. I'm going to pass it on to Tim. Thanks so much.
Sure.
Tim.
Good evening, Doctor. Thank you for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
The Democratic Party currently sits at its lowest point in percentage of elected officials since 1928. We have no elected power base from which to exert anything or oppose anything. Now, this is compounded by the fact that we will obviously, according to the map, be playing defense in the 2018 midterms coming up, which is the next time we could change some of this. The Republicans totally control the government of 37 states. With all that looking at us, what can the Democrats possibly do now to even remain relevant?
Well, I think we go through this cycle historically of saying X party is on its deathbed. And I think political parties always find a way to come back. And I think for the Democratic Party right now, they are certainly a much more diverse party than they ever have been before. And I think what they need to start looking at is beyond the traditional and perhaps look at a new generation of political leaders. You know, certainly their bench is depleted, and generally you tend to get people who are either governors or perhaps U.S. senators coming in and being the kind of next level of leadership for that party. I think for the beginning point is Democrats have to figure out, are they going to be the loyal opposition? Are they going to be like Republicans were going into the 2010 election and to say, we are not going to cooperate nor work with the Republicans? Let them do everything on their own if they can keep their party solidified. And that's always a big question, because political parties are this random collection of different factions that if one breaks off, you kind of have instability within the party and could potentially have instability within the government. So I think for Democrats, they certainly need to refocus. I think that is one of the lasting legacies. And I think he even admitted it, that President Obama said he should have spent more of his personal capital on developing those at the bottom rungs of the Democratic Party and state legislatures and governors, and be able to have that kind of deeper bench than what they have right now.
Hmm. You mentioned, you made allusion a moment ago to Trump's approval rating. He enters office with the lowest approval rating of any incoming president in modern history. Does he have political capital to spend with an approval rating like that with Congress?
Boy, I think that's going to be the real test of this unified party government. And whenever I teach this, I tell my students, you know, even though one party may be unified in terms of controlling the government, there is no such thing as true party unity. You will see some divisions play out between congressional Republicans, even within a chamber of Congress, and I'm thinking about the House Freedom Caucus versus the rest of the Republican conference. You may have some dynamics in the Senate where people like Lindsey Graham and John McCain and Jeff Flake decide to peel off. You know, if Republicans lose three of those senators, that's their majority right there. They can't get anything passed necessarily. So it is a dynamic that he is going, that President-elect Trump is going to have to work with his Republican base and supporters within Congress, but they're not always going to agree on everything. And the dynamic is, what is going to be the top couple of key policy areas that they can get passed in this first couple of months of this year before everybody starts turning to those midterm elections? And then, you know, whatever a first-term president wants is generally a second term, and then that's going to herald in 2020's election cycle. So it is going to be a dynamic of internal Republican Party politics just as much as it is Republicans versus Democrats.
Let's turn for a moment, and then I'll throw it back to David. But I wanted to ask you a question about some state politics, and it just so happens to be the state that you reside in. If there is a more interesting state in this country politically right now, I'm hard-pressed to find it. We've all read and seen the news in North Carolina. We know the background about what happened. We know how Governor Cooper got elected. We know that the legislature essentially gutted, what, two-thirds of the incoming governor's powers, and the outgoing governor signed on to it. Where does that all stand now? Are we looking at all of this going to the courts to straighten it out?
Oh, most definitely, and there's so many lawsuits flying around North Carolina, it's hard to keep up with, you know, simply because it seems to be a lawsuit of the day, you know, whether the Governor Cooper is suing the legislature, whether the legislature is suing the governor. The courts are going to be busy, and needless to say, lawyers will be well paid here in the Tar Heel State, because the dynamics of it is just, we are kind of an epitome, a microcosm, if you will, of the polarization that the country is undergoing. And I think this is playing out writ large between a legislature that is dominated by rural Republicans versus a Democratic Party that has become more and more concentrated in urban areas in the state. And so you have a very natural urban-rural divide going on. The key difference, though, is that in suburban North Carolina, it's actually more Republican than rural North Carolina. So that's kind of the dynamics of basically it's urban North Carolina versus everybody else. Being originally from South Carolina, you know, North Carolinians used to look at the brethren to the south and say, well, they're the crazy Carolina. Well, my mother once called me one night and said, are y'all vying for the title of craziest Carolina? Because now we will be glad to hand that over to y'all. And we seem to be doing quite well at it.
Yeah. Well, with such polarization, the obvious question comes up. Can the government actually function? Can it govern?
I think the prognostication is that in North Carolina, with supermajority status, the Republicans will continue to dominate North Carolina government. They have supermajority status in both chambers. They can override any veto that Governor Cooper comes out with. So it really is still a dynamic. And North Carolina has always been a legislative supremacy state, much like the original 13 colonies. The legislature was always the dominant one. The governor is a very weak governor to begin with. There are multiple offices in the executive branch elected. The North Carolina governor was the last one to get the veto power, the last one to be able to succeed him or herself. So it is certainly, you know, a dynamic that the legislature is supreme, and with supermajority status, it will continue to be that way.
Excellent analysis, Doctor. Thank you. David?
My pleasure.
Yes, following up on that, we know that a lot of the controversy surrounded Brimville, for the lack of a better name, that's what it's called. And people assume that if Roy Cooper, I did that the other week, if Roy Cooper were elected, that would be a clear sign North Carolina would repeal that bill and begin to get a lot of their events back, the All-Star game for the NBA. In fact, the city I live in, Rome, Georgia, picked up the Atlantic Coast Conference tennis tournament, even though we don't have an Atlantic Coast College within 75 miles of the county because of the bathroom bill. Are North Carolinians really anxious to get their commerce back, or how are they reacting to that?
I think everybody would just be grateful if HB2 just simply went away. The problem is you cannot resolve this issue with the grounding that both sides have worked themselves into. It is HB2. I dare say if you took a poll among rural North Carolina, it would be overwhelmingly for HB2, the bathroom bill, whatever you want to call it. If you go into an urban area, particularly Charlotte, Asheville, Raleigh, they would be overwhelmingly against it. And I think that for what we saw in the final session of the legislature last year, which was an attempt to repeal it, there was no trust between Democrats and Republicans. And until both sides feel like the other side is coming to the table with an honest attempt to reconcile and deal with this issue, I'm afraid HB2 is going to be on the books for some time. Now, we're going into a long session of the legislature this year, and the a recent lawsuit put a stay on the redistricting. I was always concerned that if the legislature was going to have to redistrict itself this year and have primary elections, there was no way they were going to touch HB2 because Republicans would be primary if they voted for it. So I think this year, if the redistricting holds off, if the special elections aren't held, there may be a slim chance of it being repealed. But there is no love lost between particularly Governor Cooper and the Republicans in the legislature, particularly those from rural areas, over this issue. And I think they are, you know, particularly for rural Republicans, they are like, we want this. We do not want cities to be able to have these kinds of non-discriminatory policies that protect and cover particularly transgender individuals. And we're basically at a stalemate.
Yes, and I'll say this, not so much from a political inclination, but just as a Georgian, I think Georgia's the biggest recipient of everything North Carolina is already losing and may lose moving forward. And then, of course, I tell Catherine and Tim this, both Georgians as well, it's just a matter of time, though, before our Republican legislature decides to do a similar bill and we'll be in the same situation, and they may have 30 of these bills across the country, and I don't know where they'll have. I guess California will get every convention and every sporting event and everything else. Well, Dr. Bitzer, I really appreciate you being on the Kudzu Vine, and hopefully if I could get my act a little better on producing, we could get you back in the future.
Be glad to do so. I've enjoyed it. Thank you all very much.
Thank you,
Thank
Dr.
Thank you so much.
Yes,
that was Dr. You too, Dr. J.M. Michael Bitzer, Bowtie Politics. If you haven't looked at his Twitter feed and you're looking at Twitter feeds, highly recommend it. A lot of intellectual graphic data on North Carolina politics, but just some good quick analysis as well. And I guess it could come through there on the interview as well. Let's go ahead and transition again to some other topics. And two individuals that I was unfamiliar with, one in Connecticut and one in Colorado, made some news over the weekend. And both, I mean, we're talking Daily Show, Saturday Night Live, will mock both of these individuals just in how they behaved this weekend in different ways. Tim, I know you always know my names for me. I'm traveling in the car, making it tough to look up names. But we have a city council or some type of municipal politician in Connecticut, of all places. He was mad at an employee, I believe it was a union employee, really did not care for how she was conducting herself. And so he decided that it would be just a great idea to grab her by the groin area and then in the police report say, I just love this new politics. You don't have to be politically correct. I guess you can get away with anything. Tim, give us that name that I'm missing if you got it in front of you.
What is his name? Give me a – the oh,
Chris, well, I'll give you some more. Who?
Christopher hang on just a minute. He called it a joke for starters.
Yeah.
Let me get back to you in a minute on that.
Yeah, and Tim, you're always so good at it. I put you on the spot and I feel bad because you're always the best at fact checking. You fact check me all
the
time.
Yeah, well, I was ready with the other guy, but
I got it.
This guy, believe it or not, is 71 years old, and the reason remember his name it sounds like something out of Transylvania or something. It's Christopher von Kieserling. He's a Republican. He's on the Greenwich Town Meeting Board, and he's been on it for over 30 years. And this apparently happened about a month ago, and he grabbed a 57-year-old woman. And the woman mentioned it was a new world politically, and he had to educate his fellow politicians. And he obviously told her, well, I love this new world. I no longer have to be politically correct. Well, he most certainly was not, was he? What is it with these 70-something-year-old people doing all of this all of a sudden.
I just could not fathom that he thought he could do this. Obviously, he's going to be brought up on charge. You know, probably has them in police report. This is assault.
Yes.
You know, I don't think Donald Trump can be a defense.
maybe in some world he thinks he's going to get in front of a jury of people that just love Donald Trump and are going to let him off because that's how Don does it. But you just can't see this happening. We kind of alluded to it with Dr. Bitzer talking about the loosening or just disregard of norms, but I just don't see this norm going away, Catherine. What do you think?
Oh, God, I hope it does. I mean, I can't – I mean, I don't know. I'm very disappointed that people – I mean, he's an elected official. I'm speechless. I'm sorry. I just
– Yeah.
What
yeah,
is wrong
I mean,
with people?
Throughout our history, we've had presidents that had qualities about them, and everybody admired them. You wanted to be honest because of Honest Abe, even George Washington and the cherry tree. Now, obviously, that may have been greatly embellished. But you had that. You had other presidents that you wanted to follow their bravery, maybe Andrew Jackson or Dwight Eisenhower. Charisma with President Obama, President Reagan. The fact that Franklin Roosevelt overcame polio to the point that he could serve as president. I mean, there's all these qualities that we admired. But now, Donald Trump, people have this quality, not all people, obviously, a minority of the people, have this quality of just unabashed, I'm going to do what I want, I'm going to be who I want to be. Kind of like the old Bobby Brown song, My Prerogative. And that's what he's brought to the table. And I can just have a sneaking feeling that a majority of the people don't think this is a good thing. It's just this vocal minority that's behaving this way. Right, Tim?
Well, I mean, this guy called the woman a blood-sucking, lazy union employee and purposely reached between her legs and grabbed her, you know, her crotch. I mean, what in the world is – did he think that that was not going to be reported or that there was not going to be hell to pay for? What was this guy thinking? I mean, what is wrong with people that they would
– He liked this new politics where there's no political correctness. That's what he was –
Well, I guess, and he thinks Donald Trump said he did this, and he got elected president. And here's the question. I think in Connecticut, he's going to pay. He's going to have charges brought. He's going to have a conviction. He's probably going to lose his spot, if it takes election or recall or whatever. But are there places that are so conservative, so Republican, so Trumpian, somewhere in, rural Alabama, rural Louisiana, wherever, maybe out west, wherever it may be, that somebody could possibly get away with something like this?
Catherine, do you think there are
some corners? Or Tim, you want to jump on it. Do you think there's somewhere where you could get away with this because it would be Trumpian?
I hate to think that there are, but I like our guest said, I think they're all predictions are off.
Yeah. Tim?
Well, one reason I have some hope, you might remember the recent deal in West Virginia for the elected, and I mean, let's face it, West Virginia went by a massive margin for Donald Trump. I think that was his second best state, if I'm not mistaken. He swept the state. A female politician there called Michelle Obama on Facebook an ape with heels, as you might recall. She got fired. That's why I have hope. Once it gets out into the public, there are going to be right-thinking local citizens that are going to say, wait a minute, no. We don't want to be known for things like this, and we're not going to allow it to happen. The question is, though, is in some of these areas, would it be buried before it got known? So,
yeah.
Yeah, and then the next question, I do want to get to our fellow from Colorado, is will if enough of these incidents happen, like, you know, Carl Palantino, the Buffalo school board member, you know, a few weeks ago, now this gentleman, the story's come out, if people see people feeling emboldened to behave this way because of Donald Trump, is there a backlash on Donald Trump? Obviously not from the 65 million of us that voted for Hillary Clinton, but more voters. Does this hurt his reputation with the people that he actually needs, that little sliver of what caused him to be president? Catherine, do you think that this could have a backlash on him, these other people?
Well, I don't think so. I just think that he's sort of Teflon at this point. About these kind of things.
To some. Yeah, I mean, to me, you can't have less than 3 million less votes and an approval rating that's upside down and truly be Teflon. It's Teflon with some.
Right. I'm talking about that
yeah.
group that you're talking about.
Yeah. Tim, what do you say? Do you say this will reflect and hurt Donald Trump in some substantive way?
You know, I've just about given up wondering at what point he is going to sink so low that, you know, people are going to say, you know what, that's enough. And the only thing that I can come back to is it's not going to be his morals. It's not going to be something he says, because, I mean, look at what all is out there now. It's going to be people's pocketbooks. If that gets hit, no politician is immune to that. That is the first thing that people think about. The first thing they vote is their pocketbook. And when it gets hit, they're going to take it out on somebody. And they're going to look to see who's in charge, and that's who they're going to take it out on. Now, it's always been that way. Now, I know Trump has changed seemingly everything of a historical nature, but I believe that one will stick. Don't you guys, don't you believe people will vote their pocketbooks when they vote nothing else?
Oh, definitely so. But I do think this will continue to hold him down. Maybe his approval rating doesn't sink lower because of incidents like this, but it's going to keep people from forgetting all the stuff they learned in the campaign and where he may never get right side up, or he might get right side up right after Inauguration Day, stay there a week, and then fall back into negative territory and never get
out. But, David, is it like advertising and the law of diminishing returns? You know, in that you put so much money into it and then you just don't get a return on your money anymore. Is there so much stuff out there just blanketed everywhere that people are just almost immune to it now? And just
you
that's
another
thing and we don't care. Yeah.
Yeah, and at times, if somebody said, name 10 things that just gall you about Donald Trump, I'd write the 10, and then I'd forget 10 more, and then 5 of the 10 I forgot. I'd be like, well, I wish I'd put it on the list. I completely forgot about whatever that was, whatever he did, whatever he said, whatever, you know, came out. Well, let's continue to move on. We know that the Republican Party this past week made a major move on repealing the Affordable Health Care Act. And a lot of constituents are starting to really make noise. And we could talk about all across the country, but the one I want to talk about was in Aurora, Colorado. The congressman there, and Tim, you're ready. Give me the name.
Yeah. That would be Representative Mike Kaufman.
Yep, Mike Kaufman. He was supposed to meet with constituents. I don't know if this was just a general meeting or just about health care. And they could tell from the vibe in the room that people liked Obamacare, the American Affordable Health Care Act, that they wanted many, if not all, the provisions of the bill to remain.
and he got a little bit of chicken and said, well, you know, instead of meeting with the group, I'm going to meet with individuals. And in the meantime, he snuck out the back door and ran away. Catherine, have you ever heard of such cowardice and chicken behavior from an elected official as this?
I can't recall that I have, but my question is, why did he even bother to schedule such a thing? You know, like, if
that,
he was not,
yeah.
You know, it seems like, I mean, maybe he misread constituents were going to be interested in, you know, maybe he thought they would be supportive, but it just seems like a political error to even schedule such a thing if he wasn't prepared to talk about the pros and cons.
Yeah, I that's why I think he had the thing scheduled, and it was probably like a open forum that they could have talked about everything.
Everybody,
of course, has health care on the mind. Tim?
It was a regularly scheduled meeting. And all of a sudden, it's generally one of those deals where just a handful of people shows up and he shakes their hands and talks to them, this and that and the other. Well, over 100 people showed up, and let's just say they weren't very happy. He saw that, and he sneaked out the back while his staff, you know, announced that Representative Kopman only hosts constituent one-on-one meetings in this district, and la-di-da-di-da-di-da. And a lot of people went away pretty angry. They didn't get to talk to him at all, but no, they weren't expecting what happened at all. Now, I think
yeah.
you're going to see that in a lot of districts, don't you?
Well, or they'll cancel the meetings before they even happen if they think
yeah.
that they'll just stop meeting
yeah,
the constituents. But, of course, you know, that's going to be a terrible look. You know what would be amazing is let's say a state has 5 Democratic congressmen, 6 Republican congressmen. The Democratic congressmen start meeting with the neighboring district. Yeah, because your guy won't meet with you, I will. And the look that would get, and if that could get news coverage, if that could get penetration, I know it's a lot of extra work on the part of the Democratic congressman, but just the fact that it would be like, I'm having to serve your people and there's less of us because you don't even meet with them. This is going to be a lot of, you know, little paper cuts that lead to a bleed out if they continue to make these kind of moves. Since Donald Trump's been elected, there has been bad news after bad news, and it's not all him. It's unforced errors like the ethics reform they tried to push through, this type of incident, health care becoming a major concern, because if health care is a topic, that's a good issue for Democrats if that's the major discussion topic. And so the Republicans are not winning news cycles lately.
You yep. saw all the votes the other day in Congress, and all the amendments Democrats offered, every one of them was voted down. We wanted to save the pre-existing condition feature of the Affordable Care Act. Very popular with people. They voted it down. The part where kids can live with stay on their parents' insurance until they're 26, that's very popular. Voted it down. Bernie Sanders' amendment to import, you know, cheaper drugs from Canada. Voted it down. People are seeing all this and they're saying, wait a minute. We didn't know they was going to do all of this. We voted for Donald Trump, but we didn't want this pre-existing condition feature to go away. We wanted to keep it. And people are suddenly very angry about that, guys, right?
Yes, and I wonder how far the Republicans will go. I think
and David,
there's a lot of folks that they want to get rid of a lot more than what President Obama did. They want to get rid of what a Lyndon Johnson and a Franklin Roosevelt did too. Tim? Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to say, if we could stay on the air for a minute, we will then find out if you can make your announcement about next week's show. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I'm not in front of a TV, Tim. So,
I am, and we're waiting on a field goal attempt to let you know.
Yeah, because but either way, with a 5 start, it's going to be tight even if we're watching that game on TV. So I think we can still make some alternative.
Well, now you can make your announcement that you will be in Atlanta, okay?
Excellent. So it will be a home game in John Lewis's 5th District, which has all kind of great building projects. Which has a lowered crime rate, which is just not whatever Donald Trump thinks it is. So good to know. So we definitely will try to have an early kudzu vine. We'll work with some people and see what we can do to get us a top-notch guest like Dr. Bitzner was tonight. But until then, do the kudzu vine.
Good night, everybody.
Bye, Ray.